Timothy Leary lives. No, 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 he's outside looking in. Timothy Leary lives. No, 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 he's outside.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh. Free Culture Radio is an examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the ineluctable, indelible, and indispensable influence of drugs on society. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs, nor condemns people for being involved in drugs. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when people who use drugs are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. This edition of Free Culture Radio is all about medical cannabis.
We should do more psychedelics.
And psychedelic drugs. My good friend Rick Doblin, PhD, is the founder and executive director of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. I was at a conference recently where he spoke, and I caught up with him for an interview. So on this edition of Free Culture Radio, we're going to hear some of that.
I want to talk to you about the psychedelic bits for a minute, because I want to know what you think about, you have watched the evolution of drug policy since the Reagan era.
Yeah. Since before, since Nixon.
Well, oh, that's right. Never mind.
I'm a little bit older than you, yes.
Technically a few years older than me, even though you look younger, and I'm still quite jealous. But, you've been watching. You should do more psychedelics. My doctor told me it's okay.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
You've watched this evolution. You've watched the evolution of the drug policy. Watched the evolution, not just the drug policy, but also the reform movement.
Yeah.
And it went from marijuana is cool, but we only want to say decrim, all the way to legalize all this stuff. And how has the marijuana movement influenced the psychedelic movement and vice versa?
Well, I think the marijuana movement has really proved this concept that medicalization leads to legalization, that medicalization is the way to change people's attitudes, because there's so much misinformation, so much government propaganda. How do you reach people? And the key that we've learned from medical marijuana is it's through people knowing medical marijuana patients, seeing dispensaries not covered with machine guns and violence, seeing the alternatives. Rob Campia one time said something very interesting to me, which was that he thought if you compare medical marijuana states versus marijuana decrim, what leads more towards changing people's attitudes towards legalization is medical marijuana, not marijuana decrim. Although decrim is about changing the law for that, so because people can see examples. So I think one of the things we've learned from the marijuana is that the movement also is that you need to be super careful not to overestimate your success. So I'm going back to the 70s where people thought, oh, it's going to be legal in a few years. And you get way overconfident and you get then taken by surprise. And so I think we need to really reach out. So now we're trying to think about the main group that we've not reached out to. It's fundamentalist Christians. In terms of, we've got the Republicans because we're so much with the veterans for MDMA, for PTSD. But how do we reach fundamentalist Christians and try to help them not be resistant to this? There's no answer to that. We haven't figured it out. But that's, I think, one thing. You learn from marijuana is you get overconfident, you get taken by surprise. I think the other thing that we've learned is that state by state and patience makes a lot of sense. One thing that I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for is state or local initiatives on medical psilocybin or medical mushrooms. And the reason why is that we have the open door towards the FDA to make the medicines. I think the kind of initiative that makes more sense to me is decrim rather than medical. Because what we've been saying for decades and decades is that the research has been blocked by the politics and let's just do the science. And that's what we've been saying for marijuana. That's what we've been saying for psychedelics. So now that the climate is changing, for people to say, oh, forget the research, we're going to do it through the politics to do medicine, it doesn't feel right to me. But what does feel right is just say, let's decrim. And what I've learned from the Drug Policy Alliance and others is that there's more support for decrim in general for all drugs than when you say decrim for psilocybin. Once you make specific drugs, people have their fears, their concerns. So I think that the initiatives that are moving forward for psilocybin decrim would be better off as overall all drug decrim, and they'd be more likely to pass?
I'm interested in what you might think about the possibility that decrim.
I'm not against these things.
Okay.
I just think they're not. I wouldn't vote against them, but I don't want to be involved in promoting them. The other thing I'll just say is that a lot of the researchers who are working with psilocybin are very frightened by these, and I think overly frightened. So I've been struggling for a decade with the psilocybin researchers who tell me that I'm hurting them because I talk about how we need to move beyond prohibition. And they think I should just talk about medical MDMA, medical psychedelics, don't talk about broad cultural change, don't talk about anything to do with, you know, ending prohibition. So because out of respect for these people's fears, because they're doing the work in psilocybin and MAPS is not really, I don't want to mess things up in their eyes, even though I think it's actually helping them. So it's kind of a difficult position I'm in.
Okay, medicalization leading to legalization,
yeah,
but decrim not leading to legalization.
No,
but
yeah, not as much.
Not as much.
Yeah.
But you think possibly the decrim of psilocybin might lead to a medicalization? Am I getting that wrong?
Okay, no. I think the medicalization really should be done through the FDA. That's just my feeling, because they're open to it.
Yeah.
And there's two companies that are trying to do it now. One profit, one not-for-profit, trying to move psilocybin through the FDA. So I just feel like medicalization should be done. And if you decrim, you get people able to use it for medicine anyway. And if you do more all-drug decrim, you're more likely to get psilocybin decrimmed than if you say we want psilocybin decrimmed.
Do you think it's possible? Do you think marijuana decrim may have helped to ease the path for medicalization?
I think it certainly doesn't hurt. Yeah, no. But I think that a lot of the decrim stuff, you know, there was like Ann Arbor, there were certain kind of decrim, but I think that the medicalization is what's really been motivating people to even further decrim and legalize.
Right on. Yeah, because seeing people, for instance.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to get to the Mutual Benefit Corporation you're talking about for drug development, because
yeah.
I hate greed, and I'm not really fond of the money-making corporate model that seems to be coming in. And so I don't know how any of the corporate money people talking about investments reacted to your notion of a mutual benefit corporation, and I don't give a flying. The question is, could you unpack that idea for folks?
Well, if you look at capitalism, it's about profit and unlimited growth. You know, and forget about the externalities. So not every company is like that at all. But in general, we're destroying the planet. And I think people are short-sighted on their narrow interests and not paying attention to the other. So the benefit corp is a modification of capitalism where you maximize public benefit, meaning you take care of you account for the externalities. You don't ignore them. And I think that's what we need. That's the problem with capitalism, is you offload the externalities on other people and you just make your profit and you don't care. And so I think that the idea of the benefit corp is the antidote to capitalism. But it is capital. It's the evolution of capital. Maybe it's a better way to say it's the evolution of capitalism, not the antidote to capitalism.
Interesting.
You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh, and we're talking about psychedelics and medical cannabis with Rick Doblin, PhD, founder and executive director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS. We ran into each other at a conference recently where he was the featured speaker for their opening reception. Let's listen to some of that audio.
What I want to share with you is a bit of the history of how research has been obstructed with marijuana to try to make it into a medicine or to do anything else, and where that's at in terms of. So right now, when we look at what kind of obstructions there are to research with Schedule I drugs, the only obstruction that's still existing is with cannabis research. We have an open door at the FDA to do the research. We've had, surprisingly, an open door at the DEA. We have a senior DEA official who has retired, who his son went into the military and got PTSD and uses cannabis for PTSD. So he is our consultant. And when we went to the DEA
December of 2017 to talk about expanded access, which means a lot more licenses. We had, you can only go in the DEA headquarters with an escort. You can't go by yourself. They always have an escort. So we had a meeting with the people that give the licenses for Schedule I research, and we met this escort, and it was going to be in the other building, but the courtyard above was being renovated. So she said, we're going to have to go through the underground parking lot to get to this other building. And I said, that's fine. We have a lot of experience in the underground. And then we get to the building, and we're going up the elevator to the fourth floor, and for some reason, the elevator doors open up on the second floor. Nobody pressed it. Nobody got in. Nobody got out. The elevator's doors close, and then we go up to the fourth floor, and our DEA consultant whispers to me, he said, that's the floor that the courtroom is on. So the last time I was in that building was in 2005 when we were suing the DEA to try to get a license to grow marijuana. And so it felt like here it was, a window onto a time of past conflict with the DEA. And then it was just a little, nobody else noticed it, but the few of us, the doors closed. Then we went up to this meeting, and we were talking with the DEA about how when we want to do expanded access, there could be hundreds of therapists that are going to need Schedule I licenses, and they're prepared for it. The meeting went really well. The only part of the meeting that fell flat a little bit was where I said, we just would like you to know that if there's any police officers from the DEA who have PTSD, we would like to welcome them into our studies. And so they didn't volunteer anybody, but at least they know that we're trying to do this reform for them. So the situation now, which probably you all know, but I'll briefly mention it and then bring you up to date, is that there's a monopoly, a 50-year monopoly that the National Institute of Drug Abuse has held on the production of marijuana for federally regulated research at the FDA. And that marijuana comes from NIDA, comes from the University of Mississippi, Professor El Soli. It's not very good quality. But more importantly than the quality is that it's only for academic research. It cannot be used as commercial sales. So when you do research with the FDA and you want to make a drug into a medicine, there's preclinical research in animals, then there's the, say, phase one studies where you're just trying to figure out mostly in healthy normals, what the drug does, how does it work. Phase two are the pilot studies where you're starting to refine your treatment methods and your doses. And then phase three are the final studies that are the large-scale, multi-site, randomized, placebo-controlled studies to try to prove safety and efficacy to make it into a medicine. And the FDA requires you to use the exact same drug that you want to market. And so since NIDA marijuana cannot be marketed, there's no way to do phase three studies with cannabis right now in the United States. And what I've been hoping for is that the Canadians who are growing, the Israelis who are growing, who recently got permission to export, that one of those foreign companies would end up being willing to open up a drug master file at the FDA for their marijuana and then let us import it, and then we could break the monopoly that way. But none of them have been willing to do it. And I think one of the reasons that they're willing, not willing to do it is that the FDA does have high standards for what a controlled, standardized product would be. But also, a lot of these different companies are starting to think about making patented medicines out of cannabis with extracts, with different delivery systems that may be very good for certain specialized indications. But for a lot of those indications, it would be a whole lot cheaper for people to smoke flower, either vape or smoke. So we've been unable to import, at least so far, and NIDA is not possible. So that's the main way that cannabis has been blocked federally from becoming a medicine in the plant form. We do have Marinol, you know, Sativex, we've got Epidiolex, but these are all extracts and patented systems. So as a nonprofit organization, as a nonprofit pharmaceutical company, our goal is what's in the best public interest. And the best in the public interest is to get the buds very inexpensive as a medicine. And I'm not sure exactly your cost structures. Maybe you could share a bit later what your cost structures are. But the Israelis are able to grow for about 50 cents a gram for high-potency trim buds. So you can get an ounce of pot at their cost for, you know, $16 or $15, something like that. And then you mark it up a couple times for retail and all of that. But it will be an extremely inexpensive. And it will eventually go generic as well. So that's our goal, is to try to do that. And so I'm so glad to see Sue Sisley is here. So I'll just say that for all of you who are old-timers who remember Brownie Mary, so I tried for a long time to find researchers that were interested in doing cannabis research, and this was starting around 1990. I couldn't find anybody, because in 1990, the FDA, the people that regulate psychedelics at the FDA, or Schedule I drugs in general, who'd been blocking all research, it shifted to a new group at the FDA, and they were willing to open the door to psychedelics and to marijuana research, but they needed people to submit applications, and nobody was doing that. So I was trying to find somebody who could do that, and nobody was willing to do it. And then Brownie Mary, who was giving marijuana brownies to AIDS patients at San Francisco General, she ended up getting arrested. She was at her dealer's house. The dealer gave her all sorts of shake and things that she could make into brownies. He got busted. She happened to be there. It was national news. And so I ended up calling all the sorts of people at the San Francisco General, and I ended up with Donald Abrams. And he was the first one, after several years of trying, that he said yes, he was willing to do it. I said, you owe it to Brownie Mary. And so we ended up getting approval for a study. We got FDA approval. We got IRB approval. NIDA refused to provide us with the marijuana. Then what happened is, in 1996, California and Arizona were the first medical marijuana states that had for dispensaries. And then NIDA was aware that their blocking research was being used as a reason to pass state-level reform. And so they approached Donald and they said, if you switch your study from looking at the benefits to looking at the risks, we'll not only give you the marijuana, but we'll pay for the study. And so we talked about it, and we said, yeah, let's do it. Any way we can start at all, we'll start. And so the primary outcome measures was about drug-drug interactions between protease inhibitors and cannabis. But the secondary measures were looking at weight gain and caloric intake, nausea, things like that. So we did sort of back into this study of getting some information about the benefits. Then what happened was I worked with Ethan Russo, and we got a project that was marijuana for migraines. This is in the late 90s. Again, the same story. FDA says yes, and the IRB say yes, and NIDA refuses to give us the marijuana. That was really frustrating. And then I realized that what we really need to do is break the NIDA monopoly. So I spent about a year trying to find, it's also good we're here at a courtroom, the Rosa Parks of medical marijuana. And that turned out to be Professor Lyle Craker at UMass Amherst. And so he was someone who had worked on classified research for the Army on defoliants for cocaine plants, coca plants. He was an expert in plant medicines. He didn't smoke marijuana. He had a senior tenured professor, and he was a compassionate man. And so he agreed that he would work with us to try to get a license.
You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh, and we're talking about psychedelics and medical cannabis with Rick Doblin, PhD. Rick is the founder and executive director of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Let's hear a little more from that speech he gave.
So luckily, the UMass Amherst keeps a copy of everything, and so they copied the application and resubmitted it. And then we waited another couple months, and we called them and we said, what's going on? And they said, I'm sorry, we can't accept your application because it's a photocopy. We need an original signature. So then we gave them that, and we waited for 3 years, and they ended up doing nothing. So finally, we sued them under the Administrative Procedures Act for unreasonable delay, and we got a hearing in 2005. And so in that hearing, a DEA administrative law judge hearing, it's like a real court, except the difference is that the judges make recommendations to the head of the agencies. They don't tell the agency what to do. And so in this case, we had it on the second floor of the DEA headquarters. The judge, in the end, agreed with us and said that the DEA should give licenses. It would be in the public interest for them to do that. This is 2005. DEA waited for 2 years, did nothing, and then 1 week before Obama got inaugurated, they rejected the application so that he would not be able to come to looking at it as a fresh thing. Then he did nothing, unfortunately. Eventually, we then sued them again in the appeals court, and we lost. The court didn't really understand what was going on and said that there was an adequate supply. But that's maybe for research, even though it's not good quality, but it wasn't adequate for drug development. So then finally there was with Sue, starting also in 2000, around then, a few years after that, what we decided was that if we were to work with veterans, and this is a big part, obviously we all know this, about how when you do research, you have to have sympathetic patient population when it's politically controversial research. So we decided that we would try to do PTSD research in veterans. You all know Sue's story. She ended up getting fired from the University of Arizona, which turned out to be a very good thing. But Sue was fantastic. So it took us 7 years to get this study approved. And in this process, part of the reason it took 7 years is there was another review process. NIDA reviews marijuana studies. In addition to FDA, IRB, and DEA, and then it was the NIDA Public Health Service review process that was blocking us. So in 2014, we managed to get rid of that. And then in 2016, two things happened. We got approval for the study, and Sue and I were like, damn, now we actually have to do the study. Sue was loving the politics, indefatigable, which do you enjoy the most, the politics or the research? Maybe we shouldn't... Equal. Okay, that's good. So, any case, we ended this Public Health Service NIDA review. And then in August of 2016, near the end of Obama's term, the DEA put a notice in the Federal Register saying that they were ready to end the government monopoly. And what was so incredible for me was that they had just two small paragraphs about how we could do this in association with, in concordance with our international treaty obligations. That had been holding up, that had been their main argument for four decades about why they couldn't give licenses because of international treaty obligations. So they admitted in these two tiny paragraphs, of course, it's no problem, they can do it. And then Lyle Craker and others submitted applications. Since then, they've got around 26 or more applications. And once the election happened and Trump got elected and he put in Attorney General Sessions, he blocked all the responses to from the DEA. So these license applications are sitting there. DEA is obligated to put everyone in the Federal Register within 30 days. They didn't do that. They're obligated to reply within 90 days. They didn't do that. And so we've been waiting and waiting and waiting. And so what just happened yesterday is that Senator Schatz from Hawaii was great. He was grilling Attorney General Barr. And Attorney General Barr committed in this discussion in the Senate during his testimony that he would end the monopoly by the end of this year. That will be more than 3 years after DEA said they would have no problem. So first off, I don't trust Attorney General Barr. And so what has just happened is that there's been a sequence of letters sent by various senators to Sessions and also to Barr. And so we're going to give Barr another month or two to see what he actually does. And then we're talking about launching a lawsuit one more time to force them to do it, because there's no reason to wait till the end of the year. So we may end up not in this courtroom, but in the DEA courtroom. And one of the most important things to think about is that medical marijuana patients across a lot of medical marijuana states have permission to buy marijuana, but they have to pay for it themselves. And so the reason to go through the FDA is both because it's federal, because I think it'll clear up a lot of fears that people have if we can prove safety and efficacy to move towards federal legalization, but also because then insurance companies will be willing to cover it. So I think it's absolutely crucial that we go through the FDA process. And we will see once we either break it through importation or through domestic production. So it's hard to say how many more years. I think it'll cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 million or so to take the cannabis plant through the FDA for PTSD. So how many of you know about the Michigan Legalization Initiative language? I guess, okay, great. A few of you do. So Rob Campia, who's a friend of mine, worked on the Michigan Legalization Initiative, which passed. But there's two lines in there that say that once they pass, if they pass legalization, that they have to spend $20 million a year for 2 years on research for veterans and veteran suicides, and that that money can only go to nonprofits or academic researchers. So that's enough, if it's allocated that way, to take the cannabis plant through the FDA. Now, as soon as that passed, a bunch of the leftover Republicans that were in the in office until January, when the powers shifted, they tried to say bad things about Sue, bad things about MAPS. We're going to take the money and spend it on psychedelics. We're going to take the money out of state. So we managed to submit information to all the legislatures, and they didn't change it. So now there is still in this bill this idea of $20 million a year for 2 years. Plus, Sue has been developing a lot of connections with researchers in Michigan, so a lot of the research should be done in Michigan. But the other point is that it's a crisis. Veteran suicides are a crisis, 20 a day committing suicide. And so it doesn't make sense to have all of the patients in Michigan, because it'll take too long, and we need multi-site studies. So this is still sort of to be negotiated with the Michigan people. So that's the summary of where we're at with trying to take cannabis through the FDA system. And what's clear is that there are not very many incentives from any of the companies that are making marijuana available on a medical basis in the states for them to fund this research, because their patients are already getting it without the research, and they're already paying for it without it being covered by insurance. So I think the market would grow, more people would pay for it, but the problem is that there's not a lot of incentive. So if we don't get this money from Michigan, most of the philanthropists who are in this marijuana reform business would rather pay for marijuana legalization than for making marijuana into a medicine, and I agree with them. So I think if it doesn't work out in Michigan, what we need to do is think about moving into some sort of, MAPS has a benefit corporation. There's different ways to make medicines into prescription medicines. Usually it's for-profit pharmaceutical industry, but the other way to do it is through what's called a benefit corporation, where what you do is it's still for profit, but you maximize public benefit, not profit. And I think when we consider healthcare, healthcare shouldn't be subject to for-profit manipulation by people who are just trying to make money out of it. Overall, healthcare suffers. So I think you could probably make a really good argument that healthcare in general, and in particular trying to make marijuana into a medicine, it should be done through some sort of benefit corp, not just a standard profit-maximizing corporation. So we'll end up having to figure out how that goes. But that's the summary of where we're at with marijuana.
You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh, and we're talking about psychedelics and medical cannabis with Rick Doblin, Ph.D. Rick's the founder and executive director of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. In this final segment of the show, let's hear a bit more from our interview.
The investment you turned down,
yeah.
How big?
Well, people are offering $50 million, but it changes everything if you start doing that. I mean, if we can't raise it for donations and we're stuck and there's people... See,
And you've raised through donations how much?
Well, in the history of MAPS, we've raised over $70 million. Shocking. In donations. And there's no private gain. Not me, not anybody. So I think the good argument about for-profit is that in general you could say nonprofits are for innovation and for-profits are for scaling. So we're still at the innovation phase, and I want to maximize therapeutic outcome rather than maximize, you know, how low we can get the cost so that it'll... But on the other hand, there are 8 to 10 million people in America with PTSD. So there's a moral argument to going as fast as you can. I just think at this point, we are going as fast as we can. And I think it would change the flavor of things if we started taking investments. But I'm not against the for-profit drug development. So let me just make that clear. I support the for-profit development of psilocybin. I support the nonprofit development of psilocybin. I just personally, with MAPS, want to continue with the nonprofit. But as I was talking during a few minutes ago, what if we want to make cannabis into a medicine and the donors would rather pay for marijuana legalization? And where are we going to get the money? What if the Michigan thing doesn't work out? Then I think you could make a good argument, but I would take an investment inside a benefit corp more so than inside a for-profit. Yeah, so MAPS one day could have. Okay, let's go back to Ibogaine.
Please, yes. Talk to me about Ibogaine.
Okay, so the very next step for Ibogaine right now is roughly $2.5 million, which is a phase 1-2 safety study in opiate addicts to address the challenges that happen. People die from Ibogaine impacting the heart. So we need to show FDA that what is that risk? What people does it happen to? Can you predict it? And if it happens, how do you block it and save people? And Jeffrey Camblett says people can be saved, that he's never had anybody die. So the next step is $2.5 million in this phase 1-2 dose response safety study. The Mission Within group is saying they want to do a study like this, but they want to do it for PTSD. So it's different to do a safety study for each different patient population. So they're talking about, they've got somebody at Stanford that they're interested in. They think that they might have these millions of dollars. They're talking about trying to do this safety study, which would be good. I hope they do it. But we need it, because each patient population has different safety risks. So we need to really do that, I think, with opiate addiction. I think we've got a real good approach towards PTSD. I think Ibogaine can be helpful for PTSD. So can psilocybin. So can the classic psychedelics. In the future, I think people with PTSD would get MDMA first, and then they might end up getting psilocybin or Ibogaine or something else for the more spiritual aspects of it. The MDMA for more working through trauma from their lives. So we're talking about psychedelic medicine, but we have to go through the FDA one drug at a time. But eventually people will have a whole range of drugs in different sequences. So we're trying now to develop a protocol. We got a grant from $10,000. A new grant for $10,000 in order to develop this protocol and budget it out for a phase 1-2 dose response safety study in opiate addicts. And also we're funding a small study, $35,000 in Afghanistan with Ibogaine for opiate addiction. It's with ICEERS, which is a group in Spain.
Yeah.
And they're also going to do an Ibogaine project in Barcelona, which is to take people off of methadone using low-dose Ibogaine, and then I think they're still working on the protocol, but what I've been suggesting to them, and they may do this, it's with Claire Wilkins, that you know you use low dose to taper people off their drugs, and then you use a high dose to try to prevent relapse, to do the psychological factors. So it's a different thing, to detox versus help people not feel the need to become addicts again.
For my benefit, how did Ibogaine, it's a drug from a plant, the iboga plant. It's from Africa, and it's being used for treating opioid addiction. It's being used for, I didn't realize, for PTSD.
Yeah.
For the benefit of folks, including myself, how does it work? What's it do? What does it do?
It's a psychedelic drug. I mean, it brings repressed material to the surface so that you can deal with it, and it also gives people a spiritual sense where they can draw strength from. So it's this, if you look at AA, you know, it's this idea about you make amends and you surrender to a higher power. So it's sort of that. Making amends is all your things that you think, you know, you've pushed away, the way you've hurt yourselves and others, and come to terms with that. And then where do you get strength from? This sense of connection. A lot of people go for addiction because they feel disconnected. They don't feel supported in human networks. So I think that's in terms of, you know, neuroscience mechanisms, so far I don't think that understanding mechanisms has helped the therapy be any more effective. Also, the FDA, to make a drug into a medicine, doesn't require you to figure out how it works. You just have to prove safety and efficacy, which makes good sense. So all that is to say I'm basically ignorant of the neuroscience of how it works, because I don't need to know it.
It works is the main thing. So that's
it works, yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So, okay, phase one, how long does that kind of research take? Phase one to the point where Ibogaine is actually a part of an accepted part of therapy, or at least a legal part of therapy.
Well, I think phase one will be a couple years, but then also we have to raise the money, get the protocol. So let's say 3 years is phase one. Then phase two is 2 or 3 years. And then phase three is another 3 years. So I think we're 8 years away. If we could start right now. You know, and maybe it can be accelerated. But we're struggling for resources. So I think the challenge, though, is to be do the first safety study, negotiate with FDA.
That was from an interview with Rick Doblin, PhD, founder and executive director of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. They're out there on the web at maps.org. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. I want to thank my guest, Rick Doblin. Many thanks to everyone out there fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. A big thank you to our engineer. And of course, thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. Free Culture Radio has a webpage at kboo.fm/freeculture. Free Culture Radio also has a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/kboofreecultureradio. Please give it a like. You'll find links there to past shows, announcements about upcoming programs and events, and other stuff like news items that may be of interest. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!